the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Hey guys, and before we get to the show, just want to let you know, brand new podcast called The Andy Carlson Show. Original, I know. Sports and other stuff coming at you 5 days a week, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. So, you have the show, visit andycarlsonshow.com/podcast or get it on Stitcher and iTunes. All right, on with the show.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Midwest Swing. This is episode number 9. You can find us at Midwest Swing Pod on Twitter. I believe we just went over the 70 follow barrier, which is pretty outstanding. You can find us, of course, on our new website, coldomaha.com, just launched yesterday. That is Tuesday for people who are keeping track at home. At Cold Omaha MN on Twitter. I am joined, as always, by my producer and maestro, Andy Carlson. At Andy Carlson Show. Andy, how are we doing?
I'm fantastic. I hate my iPhone.
Yeah, I'm not real wild about that either. I actually use a backup iPhone for recording. That way, you know, with my phone blowing up with messages from agents and people trying to get me endorsement. No, I'm just kidding. I use a backup phone just because there's less likely to be interruptions. But yeah, I hate the little one specifically. Is so hard for my fat fingers to type on, and so when we're chit-chatting before the show, I'm just like, yeah, let's just go audio so that we can actually talk because my fingers are too fat. But I have to admit, I've been inspired by you. You obviously doing the vegan thing. I've cut out caffeine for myself, so I've been obsessed with seltzer water and green tea, which I'm sure has a little bit of caffeine, but I'm trying to cut out coffee. So I just wanted to say you've been inspiring me to change some things.
That's funny because I'm okay with cutting out meat, but if I had to take out caffeine, I would rather just like launch myself into space.
Anyway, today I am joined by the internet's Michael Bauman. Michael, I tried to nail down one specific place that you're writing, and I guess Baseball Prospectus would probably be the main one, but I've obviously seen your stuff at Today's Knuckleball, which is a place I'm actually joining here in the near future.
Oh, that's exciting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just found out the other day. I had applied a couple weeks ago, and so pretty excited. Anyway, how are you, and what have I missed in terms of where you contribute?
Since leaving Grantland, replaced that one job with 3 jobs. So I'm at Baseball Prospectus a couple times a week, as well as Today's Knuckleball on the FanRag Network. And I'm also covering college baseball for D1Baseball.com.
And that's a season that just took off. We'll discuss that a little bit too. But that's always fun for me. I played a season of D3 baseball here, and it's kind of fun to think about baseball being played in February, granted less so in practice now with the Metrodome down. But we, you know, had our Florida trip, and we did get to play in the Metrodome. But my college built a brand new baseball field in the last couple of years, and this past weekend, they played the earliest game in Minnesota State history. It was warm enough to play here on, I believe it was like February, what would a couple days ago been, like 28th?
So yeah, I mean, something like that.
Pretty outstanding. So, you know, it's cool from a cold weather climate here to get out and play baseball. The funny thing is, it's been so cold since, it's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah, last year, I mean, I live in Houston, Texas now, but last year I was covering college baseball from Columbus, Ohio, and the rest of the D1 staff was out. You know, they're all in Texas or California or the Carolinas, and they're all going out and, you know, going to games the first couple days of the season. And for the first 2 weekends, I was just completely snowed in. There was nothing within 6 hours of me. So I did a couple phone interviews, and then finally I get down to Cincinnati, and there's snow on the ground. And like 2 or 3 weeks after that, I go up to the University of Michigan for a game, and it's 23 degrees at first pitch. So I took a picture of the thermometer on my car and sent it to one of my editors, Kendall Rogers, who lives here in Houston. And he was at an A&M game. He's like, sucks for you. It's 86 and sunny down here. But yeah, I love the cold weather baseball.
Oh, unbelievable. I played my senior year of high school. We had a scrimmage in 28 degrees. And I got up on a pitcher 3-0, worked a count 3-1, And so I sat on a fastball and I hit it right back up the box for a single. But it just back in those days, the aluminum or the
yeah.
The bats, it was wringing my hands for a good couple innings after that. So I was not too – you know, you want to get out of the gym and start, you know, actually throwing and hitting and doing stuff live. But sometimes you can rush it a little bit. And, you know, in far northern Minnesota, that was the case. Speaking of where I'm from, where did you get your start? Where are you from? And, you know, where did you grow up? And then where are you living now?
Grew up in southern New Jersey, just across the Delaware River from Philadelphia, and I did 4 years of undergrad at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, and then went back up north for grad school at Temple, and since then I've moved all over the place. I lived for a year in Madison, a year and change in Columbus, and now I'm in Houston.
And what was your favorite place to live of all of them?
I liked Columbus a lot. Madison, I was at work all the time. So Madison's a great city, but I live sort of on the suburbs. And so I didn't really get to enjoy it as much as I might have otherwise. But, you know, Columbus is, it doesn't get too hot. I hate the heat. Mm-hmm. Pizza you'd think that as a New Jerseyan who's lived a long time in the Midwest, I'd be a real pizza snob, but like Columbus has great pizza, which is not something I was expecting. But yeah, it's a really fun city and a really underrated place to live.
Yeah, I've heard good things about Madison. I've only been through once or twice, but it's amazing how college towns. I have a friend that is a Twins media guy that went to the university there, and he just raves about Madison. Like that's the highlight of his. Month when he gets to go back. So it's cool to hear about that kind of thing. Now, you had mentioned Houston. Is that a pretty good hub for you to see as much college baseball as you need to, or do you still travel quite a bit?
We're only a couple weeks into the season. I'm probably going to be traveling less. Like last year I was on the road pretty much every weekend, probably a little bit less so this time. But yeah, I've already been to a series between Rice and Arizona. Obviously, University of Houston's here. Houston Baptist isn't too far away. I just this past weekend covered the Shriners Hospital's Houston College Classic, which had TCU, Rice, Houston, Louisiana Lafayette, Arkansas, Texas Tech, all in Minute Maid Park. So I was at the ballpark for about 13 hours a day all weekend, which I thought I was all the way back up to baseball speed, but that definitely proved that I wasn't, because that was a really long weekend.
It's always funny when baseball season comes back around, whether it's playing or doing reporting. I always get this kind of worry, and it's funny. Mike Pelfrey told me this when he was coming back from Tommy John surgery. You have that little bit of doubt in your head that you might have forgotten how to do it in the meantime, and you just need to get back in the swing of things. It's not so much self-doubt as just being out of practice. And it's funny that Mike Pelfrey – had said, yeah, I was afraid I wasn't going to remember how to cover first base on a banana drill in spring training, or the small intricacies, when you're working 9, 10, 12 months back from Tommy John. Now, granted, you or I haven't undergone anything like that, but when you're away from the game for a while and then have to get back into the swing of things, the adjustment period can be kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's actually something that I've been thinking about a lot after last weekend. And so, since you brought it up, I'll air my own insecurities here. But like it had been, I'd covered a couple playoff games or MLB playoff games. But apart from that, it had been like 9 months since I'd been in a ballpark. So like I'm still getting back into the swing of being able to evaluate pitchers or, being able to recognize some of the minutiae, because college baseball fans there aren't a lot of them, but they're very, very intense. They demand sort of a high, sorry, my cat's trying to knock over the television. a high level of accuracy and of expertise. And so like I was sort of gingerly, I had hurt my knee a few years ago and playing hockey, and then getting out on the ice and really trusting that leg again. Like that's what it definitely felt like over the past couple weekends.
It was funny. You mentioned the cat. I have two myself. And when I had Dan Zimborski on, obviously a big cat fanatic, I had to explain to him, I have cat strategy. And what I do is I open a can of food and I lock them upstairs in the master bedroom, which has an adjoining bathroom. So they got a little bit of room to roam while I record, but it's funny. They are the kind that would come in here and start like, fighting or would start meowing. And so I definitely have to have a strategy. I've had more than one time where I've done a radio hit and they've thrown me off and it's ridiculous. It makes me laugh so much after the fact that I'm just like, guys, seriously, give me 5 minutes here. And so it just cracks me up.
Yeah, I've only got the one, but he's the size of two cats. He's about 21 pounds. And,
holy smokes. We got one that's 16.
He's extremely needy. So he's demanding attention now. I'll try to keep him in line.
No, it's cool. You had told me on Twitter recently, too, that he's got like separation issues. And so you had been out of the house for an entire day or maybe it was a couple of days doing some baseball stuff. And so when you got back, it was like you were wearing those cat slippers like on that commercial a couple of, or maybe it was last year where the cats would gravitate themselves to the feet. I had that going on when I came back from Arizona from the Fangraphs trip last year. So I can totally relate to all that. It was kind of cool too. You mentioned hockey. So where does hockey fit into this for you? Obviously as a Minnesota native, Roseau native, you know, one of the more famous hockey towns in the country. Do you just play to stay in shape or is that something you've done for a long time?
I did it a lot growing up. I actually, even growing up in New Jersey, hockey was probably the number one sport in my town just because it's Flyers country. The Flyers had their
that's huge.
Had their practice facility in my hometown. So it's a town of about 28,000 people, and there were probably about 5 or 6 full-size sheets of ice. So like everybody was into hockey in a big way. I played street hockey a lot growing up. I just played for a little over a year in Columbus just because I knew somebody who had a team. It was a lot of fun, even though I was terrible at it.
Ollie, quit. We're getting raw footage here, folks, of cat discipline.
He's knocking the DVD player off the shelf.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. He's just devious today. Now, I can't skate. I played boot hockey a lot with my coworkers at the sports company I work at. You know, a lot of fun, actually, to work with guys younger than you and to go out and play and do things. You know, big guy, I can't really skate real well. It doesn't mean you can't be in the NHL because there's some guys that are just like that. But, it's always fun to kind of get out and do that. One other thing I was thinking about, especially from a local angle, you had covered the Big Ten tournament. Was this last year that you were here?
Yeah, last year.
And so what were your impressions of Target Field? I would imagine it was one of your first visits, if not your first. And, you know, what did you come away thinking of not only the Big Ten, but the stadium and the city?
Minneapolis is one of my favorite cities. And Target Field, I'd been there, I think, about a year and a half before when I lived in Madison. I had gone.
Sure.
I just said, you know, I might never live near Minneapolis again, so I might as well, you know, hit Target Field. So, I love the stadium. It's architecturally kind of different. It's a little bit more modernist. I know the Saints ballpark in St. Paul is sort of like unabashedly modernist as opposed to like a, you know, an early 20th century knockoff the way a lot of the new ballparks are. But it's right downtown, so it's accessible by public transit. It's excuse me. Sorry. It's got really good sight lines. I love the way the skyline looks in the background. It's probably, apart from Camden Yards, my favorite ballpark in Major League Baseball. And as far as go ahead.
No, I mean that's a rousing endorsement.
Yeah, and as far as the Big Ten goes, I loved covering the Big Ten. And not only that, but I've got to a lot of MAC games and a lot of Missouri Valley games. You know, it's the quality of play is probably not quite up to SEC, ACC, but you know they got the Big Ten got 4 teams into the NCAA tournament, including a national seed. The Missouri Valley got I think two regional hosts. So it's really good baseball, and it's interesting because there's a little bit more hipster appeal up there than. It is, you know, there is down south. There's a lot of, it's really laid back. It's the fans who are into it are really into it, and there's just it's just a great atmosphere to sort of view this very high quality amateur baseball, but also without a lot of the, you know, the intensity and the, you know, maybe a little bit unhealthy insanity that you might get in say the SEC or something. But you know, the coaches are all great. I think a total of eight. I saw every team that was in the Big Ten tournament at least once beforehand and talked to all the coaches, and they've got a really good group of skilled, you know, good coaches, you know, people who had come up through the ranks at mid-major schools or had been top assistants somewhere. So yeah, I miss covering that conference for sure.
I think what's disappointing is that, if I remember correctly, Minnesota didn't even qualify for their own conference tournament in their backyard, which is disappointing. But the cool thing about the Big Ten tournament too is, whether it's a matter of player skill or proximity, the Twins always seem to land a couple of those guys in the draft. And so there's a bit of, you know, you can call it quote unquote scouting that the average fan can do, where they might remember a name or two from the tournament that the Twins pluck. And so that's kind of a fun thing too. You know, obviously it's before the draft far enough that it might, you know, some people might forget that kind of thing, but it's an option for the average fan. And, you know, if you never get to sit in the really nice seats at Target Field for a Twins game, you know, what better chance than for, you know, still really good baseball, still get a chance to, you know, really get out there and enjoy the stadium.
That's the other thing I was going to say is, you know, if in terms of like, if you want to do, you know, dip your toes in the water scouting wise, you can just walk in and pretty much sit right behind the pitcher right behind home plate at Target Field at a conference tournament like that. And, you know, last year they had the number 6 overall pick in the draft at that tournament. So, you know,
am I thinking right? Tyler J?
Yeah. Tyler J.
Yeah. So he ended up being a Twin besides.
Yeah. Although I think everybody knew about him. Not just, you know, that's not just somebody they picked up, you know, watching the Big Ten tournament a couple weeks before the draft.
And it was kind of funny. The initial reports on that pick was that the Twins were going to take Daz Cameron, and somebody had gotten some bad information. Do you think Cameron would have been a better pick for them, or do you think Jay is going to do just fine based on obviously very early preliminary things that you've seen?
Cameron was a guy who had a lot more 1-1 buzz going in. Going into last season, he sort of fell off a little bit. I think if it was just like, you know, if it was hard slots, you just pick the best player available, he probably would have gone in the teens somewhere, but he wound up falling all the way to 37 because he had higher bonus demands and the Astros were able to make that work. So given the choice between the two of them, you know, I probably saw Jay more than I saw my wife last May because I was just following Illinois all over the place. So you know, I got to know him as a pitcher really well and interview him a few times. And, you know, so I'm probably a little higher on him than normal. I think that if he was 2 inches taller, then he would have gone first overall in the draft, no question about it. Or if he was 2 inches taller and he had started all year, which is something that was, you know, probably not of interest to your podcast listeners, because, you know, maybe if we were doing this, you know, 9-10 months ago. But those two things, I think, took a pitcher who had, you know, elite level top of the rotation stuff, but who had the athleticism, who had 3 pitches, who had mid-90s velocity from the left-hand side, and dropped him a few spots. So I think if the Twins take care of him, ease him into the rotation, they could have his ceiling is probably higher than anybody they've got in the major league rotation right now. So.
But you sense he'll be a quick mover based on not only his profile and being a college pitcher, but that he's got pretty good feel for the position?
Well, it depends, because he's a guy who you could drop out of, you know, we see, you know, I don't know why Craig Hansen is the first name that came to my mind, but that's what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, we see college relievers come up and they make the majors within a couple months. You know, you could go that route, but I don't know if Jay's got, like, you know, Craig Kimbrel level elite closer stuff. I think you take him, you know, make sure he's physically acclimated to starting. I think he's got even though he's not that big, I think he's got the athleticism to hold his delivery together. You know, Illinois has a great pitching coach. You know, he, you know, taught him to sequence well, to, you know, to pick his spots. So it might take him another year or two to get to the big leagues. You know, maybe not this year, but next year we could see him coming up. But, you know, he could be a number 3 starter for the Twins, you know, within 24 months.
Yeah, that's certainly nothing to complain about. Let's take a step back a little bit. How did you cultivate your love for the game of baseball? Where did it come from? And what's the first team that you remember rooting for as a young person?
Well, I got into baseball sort of when I was in, I think it was going into first grade. You know, my parents weren't all that big into sports. My dad was sort of a casual baseball fan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think he sort of realized that this was something that I was going to need to, you know, be sort of socially literate. So we started watching a lot of Phillies games together. And that just so happened to be the summer of 1993 when the Phillies
Perfect.
Won the World Series. And I was just completely hooked from that age. You know, I read constantly as a kid. I was never a great player, you know, great athlete by any stretch of the imagination. I, you know, wasn't as good at baseball as I was at other sports, even with that limitation, but I was reading all the time. You know, I was spending, you know, a significant fraction of my allowance on a Baseball Weekly subscription, which, you know, it was Baseball Weekly back then, you know, and, you know, watching as much on TV as I could. And, you know, every week I would come home from the library. I think I read like every single baseball book that was on the shelf at Camden County Library in New Jersey, you know, by the time I was 11 or 12. So I sort of got into it through the history. And then, you know, as I was going through college I sort of came back to the present day and started, you know, reading like Jonah Carey and Keith Law and guys like that. And so, you know, that's sort of how I got into baseball.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I think I hold the Roseau County Library record for most late fees on a specific book, and it was the biggest baseball book I could find. And so I thought I was impressing a bunch of the other kids when I was in like second or third grade. Incidentally, right around 93, 94, like you. But I grabbed the book called Baseball's Best, The Hall of Fame Gallery. And the funny thing is, maybe 10 years later, I'd been out of high school for 3 or 4 years. I looked it up online, bought a copy of it. And the funny thing is, the main writer of it is Marty Apple, who had worked in, I think, PR with the Yankees. He's obviously was very close with Yogi Berra and a number of the other famous Yankees. Anyway, he and I are Facebook friends now, and it's just funny how, you know, when I was a little 8, 9-year-old kid, and obviously Facebook was not, you know, on the radar, but that was mm-hmm. kind of like my hero. And now, you know, it's cool. Like, you get that level of interaction now that you didn't have before. And so I have that copy kind of like as the main crowning jewel of my baseball bookcase. And it's funny just how, you know, I've built the shelf around it, all other books, but that's the one I keep going back to and remember reading as a kid that kind of cultivated my interest. And, you know, as I moved into adulthood, it was Ball 4 and Moneyball and the prospectus annuals and that kind of thing. And it was just funny how that all kind of evolves.
Yeah. The big author for me was, there was a guy named Dan Gutman who I don't know if you remembered, like Honus and Me, was sort of a children's book about a kid who discovers one of those famous rare Honus Wagner cards.
Oh yeah, the T206.
Yeah, so he was sort of had a certain like children's baseball literature notoriety, and he wrote a bunch of nonfiction books about baseball, including one on what he considered the 5 greatest World Series of all time. So he lived a few towns over from where I grew up and came to speak at my school. So like I probably read like, I don't know, 5 or 10 of his books. That was my go-to when I was like, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Yeah, it's amazing how much was, it sounds like both at our fingertips and the local libraries and stuff too. And so I like to encourage, you know, anybody that I see trying to get into the game, you know, go read hard copy books and learn these things and, you know, really develop a passion for it. As far as passion goes, you know, what are you passionate about outside of baseball? I think everybody who follows you on Twitter or reads your stuff can visibly see the passion and effort that you put forth there. What do you like outside of baseball that, you know, you spend time with, if you have any free time, because it sure doesn't seem like you do.
I used to read a lot. I don't read as much as I used to. I think like I've got to have the one like unabashed, you know, unattached sports attachment that that I can sort of pull all of my all of my baseball energy. Like, you know, I used to live and die with the Phillies. And then once I started writing about the Phillies, I, you know, had to sort of detach myself in order to be able to do that objectively, and poured that energy into University of South Carolina baseball. And then I started writing about college baseball. I had to take a step back from that. So, you know, now I'm sort of watching a lot of soccer and watching a lot of basketball, just because I need to, you know, be able to funnel that energy somewhere. I'm not really sure what I do apart from watch sports. There's like,
it's funny, it's the
intersection of something that, you know, what I would be doing ordinarily and also my job. So I've got to do it a lot. And, you know, that's in some way, shape or form, that's what I find myself doing most of the time.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of got to find a way to feed the beast too, whether it's, you know, I cover college basketball and football, but those aren't my passions sports-wise. It does help me, though, you know, if I read a mock NBA draft and the Timberwolves are picked to pick fifth or sixth, and somebody says, yeah, they're going to take Chris Dunn, point guard from Providence, you know, right now I know more about that than 2 years ago. And so it's kind of cool to, you know, watch, and this might touch a nerve, but the Karl Anthony Towns, Jill.
Yeah, before, you guys stole our number one picks the past couple years.
Yeah, and it's funny how, you know, a team that was so snake bitten by the draft, you know, 3-player draft and you get picked 4, a 1-player draft you get picked 2.
That's not, you know, snake bitten. You're not allowed to talk about being snake
bitten.
Well,
so when, you draft Derrick
when the
Williams
when the Wolves you... drafted Johnny Flynn and Ricky Rubio instead of ahead of Steph Curry. That's not snake bitten. Well, that's just having bad management.
Sometimes you're the snake and sometimes you're the one that gets bit, you know? And so but anyway, you know, when Shaq was available, they didn't get the number 1 pick. I believe they had the worst record but got undercut by the Magic, for instance, and ended up with like Christian Laettner or something stupid like that. You know, it always kind of seemed to double down on their bad decisions with bad luck. And so now they've in fact actually rostered the last 3 number 1 overall picks. Anthony Bennett, who was just recently cut by the Raptors, I believe. But it's funny how they kind of had to make their own luck by grabbing those 2 number 1 overall picks with Wiggins, and then they kind of get their own luck with Towns, who's been, you know, nothing short of sensational. What has been your view of watching Towns and Okafor, and do you still hold hope for Okafor to be, you know, a really nice player in the league? Granted, I don't want to, you know, sell him down the river less than a year into his career, but it does seem like it's been a tumultuous start to his time in Philly.
Yeah, I was never an Okafor fan. I think, you know, I wanted, in, you know, I don't watch a ton of college basketball, so this was like just completely, you know, an off the cuff, you know, fan list that I had, but I think I had Towns 1, I had Mario Hezonja number 2, and Porzingis number 3, and Okafor not until like 7 or 8.
So after Russell, for sure, I'm imagining.
Yeah, I didn't like Russell all that much either.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so but I definitely had him in front of Okafor.
And
but,
what about like Justice Winslow and Cauley Stein, any of those guys you have ahead of
so
like,
I think
Okafor?
Cauley Stein, I think I liked as a player better, but sure, he was sort of he would have been redundant with Nerlens Noel, and that's right. Sort of like the Sixers have just drafted best player available, and it's just so happened that the best player available every single time has been a center.
All those bigs, man.
Right. So, you know, at some point they've got to start drafting for fit, and if they're going to play 2 of their centers together, they've got a bunch of guys who could be useful sort of undersized power forwards, but they can't, you know, but they're playing small forward. With trying to fit Noel and Okafor together. And I think what they intended to do was, honestly, it wouldn't shock me if they tried to do something with Okafor and the Knicks like they did with the Magic a couple years ago, where they just went ahead and picked Elfrid Payton at 10, knowing that the Magic wanted him, and said, okay, now what do you give us for Elfrid Payton?
So basically extortion.
Yeah, pretty much, you know, not extortion, but, you know, they definitely did, you know, say, you know, what do you give us to not drop this guy off the bridge?
Sure.
And they got a first pick or first round pick back that they had traded previously. And I was sort of hoping for something like that. But the thing about Okafor is that if you've got a, and this was Zach Lowe was talking about this on his podcast, like if you can succeed with a player like that offensively if he can sort of pass inside out. Like if he you can run the offense through him and he can kick it out to other people and start the ball moving again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what his reputation was at Duke. And he came to the NBA and he just stopped passing. So what happens now is they dump the ball inside to the post because he's the only guy on the team who can get his own shot. And he extends his arm and palms the ball and sort of, you know, stares it at the guy who's guarding him. And then he, you know, does his seven step move and he picks it. He picks his seven step move before he actually makes any movement towards the basket and doesn't alter it and has no plan B. He's just going to do what he decided to do before the play, no matter what happens during the play. He never passes out. He never, you know, uses a counter move.
Does he like telegraph it?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, sometimes it works anyway because his post moves are so good, but
mm-hmm.
it's just, and all this takes 8, 9, 10 seconds to pull off. It is just the most excruciating thing for a team that, like, for the first 2 years of the process, they were actually pretty fun to watch because everybody was long and athletic and running hard, and Okafor is just he's just so the opposite of everything that they were doing. And like Noel was sort of where I was hoping the team was going, where it was very high energy, athletic, and you know, maybe a little lacking on the ball skills, but you can forgive that. But Okafor is just the complete opposite, and I can't wait to be rid of him.
Yeah, it sounds like you had the Timberwolves beforehand and have kind of fallen into, you know, a darker place. The Timberwolves, again, obviously not a very good team, but pretty compelling to watch, at least, you mm-hmm. know, from a casual observer standpoint.
I had visions in my mind of playing Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns together and using Noel on a wing defensively. And was just, you know, have those three guys stretch their arms out together and nobody would ever get by them. But I've got a lot of baggage about the Wolves. I mean, at least the Sixers, the Wolves are the only team the Sixers can't lose to, it seems like. So that's a little bit of a consolation.
Oh, while we're talking about the Wolves, I do have to mention this too. This edition of Midwest Swing is brought to you by Ticket King Online, your local ticket broker for the past 25 years. No fees, so unlike those big websites, no fees. Timberwolves are one of their trusted partners. They've got a flash ticketing system, so you can work with them to resell seats, you know, if there's a game you can't make it to or anything like that. But everywhere in the Twin Cities, not just the professional teams, you can go to the Guthrie, you can go to any of the theaters in the theater district, all kinds of cool stuff going on there too. You can pick up in-store in Minneapolis and pay no delivery fees. They're open 7 days a week. And the office is right by the Guthrie, not far from the new U.S. Bank Stadium. So Ticket King Online, promo code COLD, that is for Cold Omaha, COLD, for $10 off any order over $100 in March. Keep it local. Ticket King Online. Promo is COLD. So one thing I wanted to bring up was, obviously, you know, with all these different writing places, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades. But what would you consider to be your specialty? I watch you write things and can't believe that we've ever written for any of the same places, because I am jealous. I have to admit how you can put things out there and articulate it. But do you have one thing that you consider your specialty, or do you kind of juggle back and forth?
You know, that's very flattering of you to say, first of all. But what I bring to the table, like, you know, why you'd hire me and not somebody else, is that this sort of fits into that now famous Ryan Watt baseball prospectus column from a few weeks ago about intersectionality in sports writing, is, mm-hmm. you know, my ability to make connections between something that's going on in sports and something that's going on in art or religion or politics or economics, and, you know, use sports as a metaphor to explain other phenomena in culture or life or whatever. You know, my favorite sports book ever written was a book by an Anglo-Dutch author named Simon Cooper, who, when he was in his early 20s in the, I think, like 1993, 94, was traveling around the world exploring soccer cultures in about a dozen different countries. And he used soccer to explain contemporary politics and everything from the Stalinist Soviet Union to the United States after the Cold War to, Ukraine after the dissolution of the USSR, and the book's called Football Against the Enemy. And it's, that's sort of, I read that and I was like, that's what I want to be able to do. So, there are other things I do well. Like, I enjoy reporting features. I enjoy writing pretty much straightforward analysis and columns and stuff. But there's a difference between what I can do and what I think my specialty is, which, if that sounds extremely arrogant and pretentious, then, I guess I am. So,
yeah, if people think that, they can suck it. But so you recently, this was actually an article that stood out to me because the qualifying offer system has come under scrutiny. Maybe not scrutiny to every single fan, but, for me, wanting to see a better way to get players paid, to see teams penalized or not penalized based on what's fair, I found it very interesting. And so, with the current system, it's very clear that the players in kind of the middle tier are being punished. Mm-hmm. They didn't really choose to be offered a qualifying offer. And by accepting it, they're shortening their shelf life as a free agent. By declining it, they're shortening their list of suitors. And that's not really totally fair. And so, first of all, I want to know, when you went into kind of researching this and writing it, did your views change at all? Or did you kind of come away feeling vindicated with what your view was beginning to end in the process of writing this article?
Yeah, that's something that I've sort of, I don't think that I really exposed anything new or controversial. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, the whole point of free agent compensation is to depress salaries for sort of those second tier free agents. And they've saved owners, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars just in the first couple years of the CBA that was signed in 2011. And, if there's a recurring thread in the stuff I write, it's that it's sort of a pushback against the team-centered focus. And this is something that I've sort of realized in the past few years, or not even years, months, that because the team is the operative unit of fandom, or a beat writer or a columnist gets assigned to cover the team is what's considered to be important. And the players are just interchangeable parts. And, there's no other way I can think of being a baseball fan, but it has this insidious side quality of rooting for the team at the expense of the players. The players are only useful in service of the team. And certainly as Minnesotan, you're aware of the way that Twins fans, just to my continual bafflement, have turned on Joe Mauer for reasons passing understanding. But we have all these, when we say good contract, it means the player's not being paid much. When we say bad contract, it means he's being paid too much. And, I Colton Wong just signed an under market extension, and I will shed no tears for, a guy born in the 90s who's going to be making $25 million over the next few years. But it's it's a philosophy that bleeds over into real life. And we expect ordinary laborers to work more for less pay for good of the company. And, that doesn't – when you're applying that logic to someone who's, working at an insurance company or a factory or something, making $30,000 a year or $50,000 a year, it's the moral calculus becomes different. And so using – if they're going to – if – this is a very quote-unquote pro-business media climate for mm-hmm. Major League Baseball teams. So as someone who's deeply distrustful of the free market and has pretty considerably leftist or even Marxist views on labor and economics, I sort of think it's my job to push back on that, at least to the point where it's not the default assumption. To recognize that this isn't, this 25-year-old multimillionaire who, and you know, there's always a racial component to it, and you know, who doesn't look like you, who has tattoos and you know, drives Yoannis Cespedes's ridiculous three-wheeled cars.
Made you by know, Polaris, this, I might add.
Yeah, which is
Roseau, Minnesota's own Polaris Industries. Okay. Yeah, you where can, I grew up.
I wouldn't think that you'd drive a, you know, you'd build a an open top track day car in a place where it snows that much.
I think they manufacture them elsewhere, but that's where it all started with the snowmobiles and stuff. It's crazy. But anyway, I'm detracting from your very strong message here.
You know, it's not them. It's not millionaires versus billionaires. It's the same thing that goes on in your office between you and your boss. And that's why I try to frame, you know, when I talked about Michael Franco reporting to camp or Chris Bryant's service time or Matt Harvey's innings limit, like it's not these others against these others with whom we have no connection apart from watching them on TV. It's, you know, the same thing is going on between you and your boss, you know, every day. So, you know, people don't say stick to sports to me anymore. Just, you know, because I think they've realized that's sort of a fool's errand. But, you know, the thing I keep going back to is all sports are political. And just repeating the standard, you know, party line, that's a, you know, that's a political choice. And, you know, not repeating it or interrogating it or questioning it or exposing some of the dangers or fallacies or whatever, you know, that's the sort of political choice, you know, I make in my own writing.
Do you And it's easy for you and it's easy for me to understand what you're saying, but do you find it difficult or that there's a large sect of people that will just never be reached or are very difficult to reach when it comes to the idea that players are making millions, owners are making billions, and that they're looking through the entire wrong spectrum of who's being greedy here? Do you find that those people are hard to reach, or have you just decided whoever you reach is whoever you reach and whoever gets lost along the way just kind of stays lost?
I think, you know, I try to make these arguments, and this is, you know, I'm proud when people come back and tell me, you know, I've never thought of it this way, or, you know, I'd never had it explained to me this way before. And that's sort of what I'm going for. So I try to make, you know, I went to grad school for political science. So, you know, it would be very easy for me to slip back into jargon, but you know, that's not good writing. So, mm-hmm. you know, I try to make it as accessible as possible to, you know, not fall back on, oh, you know, this is, you know, Michael Franco's being alienated from his labor or whatever, you know, to sort of put that into terms that everybody understands. And that's why I always frame it in, you know, everybody understands the labor management struggle. You know, anybody who's ever held down a job understands that. So, you know, that management's job is to get the most out of labor for as little, you know, as little as possible. And there are some people who object to that philosophically. Yeah. And those people, you know, they, you know, I stand no chance of persuading them and, or no more chance of persuading them than they do of persuading me.
Do you think
that's fine? But
do you think they're willfully obtuse, or is it that money complicates the judgment of people, and so they can't make that parallel in their mind, even though it is pretty much identical to whatever they go through on a daily basis?
I think it's really tough to, you know, because like I said, you know, Colton Wong's 100,000 times better off than I am in terms of, you know, money and job security or whatever. Sure. So, you know, I don't feel too bad for him, but it's sort of it's less advantageous for the point I'm making that the numbers are so out of whack with what normal people make.
Yeah.
But it's also nice that we have numbers that are demonstrable that I can, you know, we can see, you know, players are making less and less money compared to as an overall share of the pie, as opposed to 20 years ago or whatever. You know, owners, you know, what do owners provide? You know, what do players provide? What are they selling? Who does it serve? And so having numbers to work with, I think, is more useful. And, you know, there are other people who are sort of attached to that, to the kind of, you know, pro-business, you know, anti-worker, I would say, you know, anti-humanistic rhetoric. And, you know, I'm not going to reach them and, you know, I'll live with that. Yeah, you know, I don't lose any sleep over that.
But I mean, in some sense, you're fighting for the same thing that you're fighting for yourself, which is to be paid a living wage for the thing that you are skilled at and more skilled at than the average person. I mean, isn't that pretty much true? And that's kind of how you can draw a passion for fighting these issues, is because, you know, you see the lowering quality or the lowering amount of money paid to writers too. And again, it's not the same level, and people will probably poke fun at that, but you can kind of feel some level of connection to that. And I think that's what you've been saying all along, but I just kind of want to drive that point home.
Yeah, that, I mean, this is an academic for me. Like, this is, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I'm not, you know, on the breadline or whatever, you know.
Sure.
I'm married, you know, my wife and I have a, you know, pretty solidly middle-class existence right now. But this, I mean, this whole economic bent on sports sort of came to me. I've been writing about the Phillies just for fun, blogging for about 3 years at a couple places, including Crash Burn Alley, before I started writing for Grantland. And that happened at about the same time I was working at a software company. And the way that this company turned huge profits was to take people right out of college who were high-achieving people, who were used to studying all the time, pushing themselves, and to sort of warp that high-achieving type A personality into the service of this company, to pitch the company itself as a moral good. And, you know, I had studied, you know, political philosophy a little bit in grad school. And so, like, I think I came into it with a little more of a, and, you know, I left grad school because I was just so unhappy with it. And so, you know, so unhappy with my work-life balance. And I never really bought into it. And I thought it was just really sinister and really grotesque the way that, you know, this company was warping, you know, this, you know, let's all do good together. We're all in it together, while, you know, not paying its labor force what, you know, the value of what its labor was worth. And so that turned into, you know, honestly, you know, it was something that I really resented and made me angry. And that anger sort of pulled through in my writing. And then, you know, trying to, you know, I realized that trying to make it as a sports writer, particularly the route I took where I didn't come through, like, I'd had journalism jobs before, but I didn't have, like a strict sports beat before. And so, you know, trying to jump over from the blog side to, for lack of a better word, to trying to make a full-time living out of that is extremely difficult. And when people, you know, ask me, hey, you know, how'd you do this? You know, how can I do it? And I say, don't, you know, go get a real job that lets you do this on the side, if this is something that you're really fun at, or that you're having a lot of fun doing. Cause I think the time where you can do what Bill Simmons did, for instance, is just, it's completely come and gone. There's just so much free labor out there. People who are either willing to do it for fun or trying to strike it rich, you know, trying to be, you know, to be the next Bill Simmons or Craig Calcaterra or whoever, to turn this hobby into a job. And there's so much supply that people aren't, or that the media companies who care more about profits than, you know, putting out avant-garde or, you know, particularly thoughtful writing, you know, they want to, you know, fill page view quotas. Or, and I don't mean that as pejorative either, because, you know, that's what they're in it for. They're not in it for the good of society or the good of the sport. They're in it for the bottom line. And the way to do that is to get a ton of low paid part-time people to, or free labor to, you know, to work for free. So, and this, you know, this includes, you know, pretty much every site I've worked for, except for Grantland. So, you know, and, you know, I certainly don't begrudge those companies that are just trying to survive themselves, their business model. It's, you know, it's the way that modern American economics works. But, you know, what I tell people now is, you know, if you feel passionate about this, if this is something you want to do, go get a day job that lets you do this as a hobby. You know, don't expect to make this a career. I think, you know, I came in late, and I'm just trying to hang on to the, you know, the last rung of the ladder, hanging from the helicopter as it pulls away.
Yeah, I've told people, for every 100 people that want to make a career out of sports writing, maybe one gets to. Fortunately, I've been one of those people, and that's not me bragging. I scratched and clawed for.
No, you can brag. It's tough.
I've scratched and clawed for a very long time, and I still am doing all kinds of stuff on the side too. It's just a level of self-preservation. Yeah. Do you think there's some form of pendulum effect where it can come full circle and be a viable thing again? Or do you think it's just a part of the evolution and something new is waiting in front of us that might or might not provide enough careers to satisfy the amount of people that are flocking to that job?
I think there's going to be – so there. The problem is, honestly, that there's more labor coming in than there are spots available, you know, even in terms of you know, traditional writing jobs on major websites or newspapers or magazines. And, you know, the people are working longer. You know, these writers who in their 50s and 60s who ought to be retiring by now are either getting bought out and trying to find other work. They're just trying to scrape by themselves. Or, you know, you got people who have the cushy $500,000 a year ESPN talking head gig, and they're not going to retire. You know, you're going to have to wheel those guys out of there in a casket. Right. So those jobs at the top aren't opening up, and it's, you know, this is how you get, you know, you must have, you know, and, you know, I'm only in this because I couldn't find a job, you know, in what I went to school for. So, you know, and I was looking for work, and, you know, for this unpaid internship, you must have 2 years of experience or whatever. And that's sort of what, you know, what the writing business is now. So, you know, I've never had a full-time job as a sports writer. Even now, you know, I work on the side as a, you know, I have three writing jobs. I have another non-writing job, and none of them give me health insurance, you know, for instance. That's the thing I keep going back to, and I'm extremely lucky. You know, I had breaks that I wouldn't ask anybody to count on. So
when
it's just – go ahead. Yeah, I'm just sort of rambling here.
Well, when you talk about the writing being team-friendly – do you think that's protecting access nowadays, or do you think there's another angle to it that is something I haven't uncovered here that you might have thought about?
I think it's – so writing being team friendly, yes, I think access plays a part of it. I think, you know, there are sectors of the media where access is extremely important, and for that reason I make a point – you know, maybe a little bit to the detriment of my writing now, but I never, ever, ever want to be dependent on access to be able to do what I'm doing.
Sure.
And, you know, there are places where I've pulled punches because, you know, I knew somebody in the organization, or, you know, I liked a coach, you know, a college coach. And, you know, I look back on those and kick myself every time I do it. You know, some of it is just, you know, you don't want to kill this guy that you like when, you know, he's just trying to do his job. But, you know, some of it is protecting access, protecting those relationships. And that's, you know, that's why this isn't a, you know, Ken Rosenthal's job is just so insane. I would never in a million years want to do it, right. But I don't want to do it also because I don't want to have to protect relationships with sources, you know, for better or worse. And I think, you know, I think some of it is also like, you know, people like me came through, you know, I came through a Sixer-centric blog. I came through a Philly-centric blog. And, you know, I got into writing about baseball and basketball because I'm a Sixers and Phillies fan. And tough for people who I think, you know, had no journalism training or who have only ever viewed the sport through this one lens to shed that team allegiance. And I think I'm able to sort of still wear my allegiance or my background or my homerism on my sleeve a little bit while still being able to discuss these teams objectively. And I think that's a really tough balance to strike.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we'd gone down this road talking about the qualifying offer to bring that discussion full circle before we move on to something else. Do you think it's going to be a hotly contested issue in the negotiations for the next CBA? And what kind of resolution do you think could be coming?
No, I don't. I think this will be something that gets resolved. They take away the part where the team loses a draft pick for signing a free agent in exchange for somehow screwing amateur players again. You know, I have been very vocal in my criticism of Tony Clark as executive director of the MLBPA. I think the labor union right now values labor pieces as an end or as a positive end in its own, or in its own right. And, you know, that's not, I don't think that's a healthy attitude for organized labor in baseball, but you know, that's sort of
basically,
how it is right
basically
now.
They're choosing results over process.
There's, I mean, it's not even results. They're choosing, you know, they're just choosing to avoid conflict. And I think that the issues that affect older players who carry the sway in the union, management will always sell labor down the river, and older labor will always sell younger labor down the river. Those are the immutable laws of labor relations in sports, as far as I see them. And you know, particularly when minor leaguers and amateur players who will one day become MLBPA members but aren't yet, once, you know, they have no voice in these negotiations. So that's why Chris Bryant gets held down an extra 2 weeks and has to wait an extra year for free agency, for instance.
Right.
And it's because of a system negotiated by other people who don't have the interests of the people who have to live under it longer at heart. And, you know, since all sports are political, you know, this is sort of what's going on at the macro level in American politics, where, you know, we see, you know, our parents and grandparents' generation, you know, negotiating to split up our inheritance and pull up the ladder behind them. So this is, you know, everything is connected.
Yeah, absolutely. And very fascinating. And I wish we weren't switching directions here, but I think we'll go down the avenue of college baseball, which is,
yeah.
You said you were writing for D1 baseball. Based on your location or based on your travels, what teams do you suspect you will see the most this season?
Well, I've already seen Rice 6 times, so that's
kind of the leader in the clubhouse. So
yeah,
to speak,
you know, they'll probably get a little less interesting just because their conference isn't as strong. Mm-hmm. Right now, I've got plans to see Dallas Baptist, and you know, I've seen TCU once. I will probably go see them again at some point. I've got a trip to Louisiana planned at some point for LSU. Going to probably see Texas and Baylor. And you know, U of H, you know, I've seen them 3 times just at this conference this past weekend. But Rice, just because of the proximity, is probably the team I will wind up on my dance card the most this year.
And so this will be partially related, partially not, but we can tie in your Phillies fandom too. What are you looking at? Obviously very, very preliminary. Maybe we'll have you on again later as the time gets closer, but for the top of the draft, what kind of guys do you see going there, specifically to the Phillies at number one?
So here's I've been thinking about this a lot recently, because the names that have been getting tossed out around there are 3 pitchers. A.J. Puck from the University of Florida, Alec Hansen from Oklahoma, and a high school pitcher from South Jersey named Jason Groom. And Keith Law said something like he didn't give specifics, but he said it in such a way, with such certainty, that makes it seem like the Phillies are just completely out on Groom.
Yeah, he was pretty dismissive, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know anything for certain either, but you know, I would be inclined to trust that, to trust that evaluation, at least for the time being. And you know, obviously, it's 2 weeks into the college season. I don't think that we can really draw any definitive conclusions. But neither Hansen nor Puck has looked good at all. So far this season, Puck got beat up pretty good by Miami last weekend. So I think this would create an opportunity for the Phillies to leverage the number one pick in a different way, which would be to sign somebody who maybe might have been back end of the top 10, get him to take a few million dollars less, and sort of sign overslot guys. You know, the Astros did this.
Muscle up the rest of the draft.
Yeah, you know, they sort of punted on the number 5 pick last year and used that savings to get Cameron. So, you know, instead of getting the 2nd, 5th, and 37th best players in the draft, they probably got, you know, 2, 15 and 18 or something. So I could see the Phillies doing something like that. And obviously this is a first draft for the Matt Klentak, Andy McPhail administration. So we don't have any kind of drafting track record to go on.
Yeah, former Twins executive Andy McPhail, I might add.
Yeah, I mean, he's been a former everything executive at this point.
I believe he preceded Terry Ryan as GM. But what did he do? He went to the Cubs. Was he with the Orioles for a while?
Yeah, he was with the – I forget if he was team president or just general manager, but he was an Oriole for a while too, yeah.
Saw him on the game yesterday, actually, the first televised game of spring training, which is always kind of fun too. A couple of local guys who are in the mix, I think, for first-round selections. You know, we got a lot of Minnesota people that listen to the podcast, mm-hmm. or a high percentage. I won't say we have a high number of listeners. Let's hope that changes. But Ryan Bolt, the outfielder from Nebraska.
Yeah.
Logan Shore, the starting pitcher down in Florida. What do you see from those guys? What's kind of the buzz or rumbling, or what has been your read on the situation? I think, was it you or was it Eric Longenhagen that told me that Bolt probably wouldn't be the kind of guy the Twins would focus on in the teens?
Yeah, that I think that was me. I told you that. I don't know if Longenhagen said that too.
Okay.
If he did, I would obviously agree with him. Yeah, I haven't seen Shore in person. I'll say that, you know, Puck is the number one, probably the number one college pitcher. Shore, his teammate, is starting on Friday nights ahead of Puck. And, you know, this is something that happens a lot at schools like Florida or even Vanderbilt, who just have, you know, Florida's got three, no doubt, number one or first round talents, Puck and Shore for this year. And Alex Fado, who's a sophomore who will be in the draft next season. And Fado started what was almost a combined no hitter against Miami on Sunday. So, you know, Shore and Fado are doing a little better than Puck right now. And, you know, last time I think we saw something like this in one rotation was the 2011 draft with UCLA, where they had Garrett Cole go number one and Trevor Bauer go number three. And, you know, Bauer was viewed as the better college pitcher at the time, and Cole was viewed as the better pro prospect because, you know, Cole threw 100 miles an hour, but it was dead straight. He wasn't getting much movement on his fastball back then, so he got hit around a little bit more at UCLA, and Bauer was the number one starter. I don't think Puck's as good a prospect as Cole, and I don't think Shore's as good a prospect as Bauer was at the time, but it's that sort of dynamic where Shore is a little better pitcher now. Puck, who's, you know, 13 feet tall and throws 97 miles an hour and, you know, with huge breaking ball from the left side, you know, Puck is the guy you go get at 1-1. I think Shore is, you know, maybe somewhere in the teens. He, you know, depending on how he pitches this season, he could go anywhere from, you know, back end of the top 10, maybe to somewhere in the second round. So he's definitely, I think, in play for where the Twins are drafted.
I think he fanned eight batters in his first start as well. Is that what he was missing to kind of rocket up lists? Obviously, the strikeout numbers were not overwhelming last year in Florida, or is it really not so much about results and more about measurables for guys in the draft?
Yeah, I think it's more measurables. You know, being right-handed, being a little bit smaller. You know, Puck, you know, undeniably has the better stuff. And this, you know, they've got Florida's just completely loaded. They've got a couple other guys who aren't even gonna pitch on the weekend this year, who could go in the back half of the first round. So this is not the first time that they've done that. They had, I think it was in 2012, Jonathan Crawford wound up being a first rounder, and, you know, he was, you know, a midweek starter for them. And then, you know, he finally gets into the rotation. He throws a no-hitter in the NCAA tournament. The Tigers pick him, like, in the late 20s. So this is, you know, that's the kind of program that the Florida's got down there. It's just monster after monster.
And so Bolt is playing.
Oh, Bolt, yeah.
Well, he's playing for Darren Erstad at Nebraska. Erstad is obviously also a name that's very popular around here. The North Dakota pedigree, and obviously I think he won a batting title with the Angels. And, mm-hmm. you know, very good center fielder, very good first baseman. So obviously you can see why a guy would want to go down there and play. Bolt had a catastrophic knee or some sort of leg injury in high school that cost him his senior season, probably cost him a chance of going real high in that draft. Has he helped his stock at Nebraska? Has he stayed stagnant? You know, he didn't hit for much power last year. You know, what's kind of the prospectus for him going into this June's draft?
He's sort of a guy who you drop all, you know, you don't drop any sixes or sevens on him, but you'll see a lot of fives on his scouting report. He's, you know, he's a great athlete. He's, you know, got a certainly enough hit tool. I saw him a lot last year, but he was hurt most of the time. So, and I think that's the biggest knock on him is, you know, there's not much doubt that there's enough in there to be a, you know, a starting major league center fielder. It's just, can he remain healthy, not only enough to provide value for a team, but to develop properly? You know, right. He was, and it's, you know, some of it's been recurring stuff. Some of it's just been bad luck. Like in the Big Ten tournament, I think the first game he fouled the ball off the foot or off of his foot and then missed the next one. So, you know, I liked Aaron Erstad a lot as a coach. I like what he's done at Nebraska. You know, I'm probably a little lower on Bolt than people who have seen him when he was healthier, but you know, I acknowledge that. I think he's probably back into the first round, early second, depending on what he does this spring.
Well, cool. That's obviously great news for local fans. That's, you know, like you said, college fans are a little more rabid, a little bit more in tune with it. And so I think that we'll kind of scratch that itch for them. Let's do this. Let's talk a little Phillies before we let you go. How does that sound?
All right.
Okay. So I want to get your thoughts on the rebuild. Obviously, you know, there were some big bloated contracts to get out of the way. Those are pretty much all, I think they're all coming off the books at the end of this year. Yes. But what has been your overwhelming vision of this rebuild in terms of maybe how long it's taken and the steps that have been taken?
So there are two things you can do once you do what the Phillies did in the late 2000s, which, you know, they built the core almost entirely through the draft and international spending. They made a couple savvy moves to get them over the top to win the World Series. And around 2010 or so, you get guys who are heading towards free agency, who are maybe heading towards their peak around age 30. And there are two things you can do. You can either double down and ride it out, which is what the Phillies did. And they, you know, the last two teams of that, you know, honestly, the Phillies got better every year from 2006 to 2011, even though they won the World Series a little bit earlier in that time range. They were much better in 2011 than they were in 2008, and they just didn't get the bounces in the postseason. So, you know, if they had won another World Series title, I don't think Ruben Amaro would be persona non grata in Philadelphia right now. The flip side of that is that once it crashes, it all crashes in a hurry. You know, Roy Halladay just completely dropped off the face of the earth. Ryan Howard stopped hitting. Cliff Lee got hurt a couple times. Roy Oswalt, you know, I don't think he ever pitched really effectively in the major leagues again after 2011. And, you know, Chase Utley got old. Jimmy Rollins got old. So once it became clear in mid-2012 when the Phillies weren't going to contend for the division title again, that their window was shut, I think since then they did a pretty good job. Now, what I would have rather they done is sort of what the Red Sox did. You know, the Red Sox do after every World Series they win, you know, once every 5 years, is that they, instead of waiting for Jason Worth to get to free agency or extending Ryan Howard, is they trade those guys and then rebuild the farm system with people who are close to the top and then get the replacement. So by the time Ryan Howard hits free agency, they've got the next first baseman ready to go in AAA. And I think that the Phillies did a really, really bad job of drafting and developing while they were succeeding on the major leagues. So once they recognize that, and I give Ruben Amaro a lot of credit for that, you know, he got stuff back for Shane Victorino when he had no value. They got stuff back, you know, they got a legitimate prospect back for John McDonald. I thought he knocked the Cole Hamels trade out of the park. And right now this is a top-tier farm system with a couple pieces in the majors already in Vincent Velasquez, Aaron Nola, Michael Franco, and then Nick Williams, Jorge Alfaro, and most importantly, J.P. Crawford will be up within the next 12 months. So I think this will be just sort of like Pat Gillick took over for, you know, with a farm system that had been stocked by the much maligned Ed Wade and won a World Series with it. I think Matt Klentak is going to get the benefit of Ruben Amaro selling off and riding out the string. And maybe someday there will be some revisionist history and Amaro will be not exonerated for his failures of 2010, 11, 12, but, you know, maybe those failures will be mitigated a little bit by the savvy moves he made in 2013, 14, and 15.
All right, we're in business.
All right.
Okay, so obviously, yeah, they're moving in the right direction. There is a player on that you didn't mention that went kind of high in my score sheet list. It looks like he's going to start in left field. And I don't even know if I'm going to say this right, but Aaron Altair. What's the deal with him? What is going to be his future role? Because I saw him go pretty high, again, like I said, in score sheet, and I was just like, you know, I'm not really super familiar with this cat.
Huh. That is interesting, because he's definitely not the top name among people I didn't list. He's sort of a rangy corner guy who's probably going to take over for Dom Brown in right field this year. And they're, okay. You know, he's sort of lean, runs okay, has enough power. I don't know that he's like a future star. He's probably, you know, he'll kick around the major leagues for a few years. He's the interesting thing about him is he was born in Germany. So one of the Crashburn writers, Brad Angler, has been trying to get the nickname the Rhineland Rocket to stick on him.
So outstanding.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. So we're you know, if you could pass that along to sort of the upper Midwest, you know, both of us would be extremely grateful.
Well, we got Max Kepler to deal with too. Maybe we can get That's some true. Kind of synergy. Yeah, it was surprising to me that he went so early, but it was Todd Zola who took him. I think Zola is I don't know if he's a regular Phillies fan or what, but you know, he went higher than I had anticipated, and it's just always interesting to hear from you know, an expert's angle there. You know what you think?
It's a little surprising to me too.
Are you big on Odubel Herrera?
You know,
I don't know how to say all these names.
Odubel Herrera, yeah. He's okay. He hit really well. I think the Phillies got Shane Victorino in the Rule 5 draft, and ever since then there's sort of been an organizational fixation on getting the next Shane Victorino out of the Rule 5 draft. So they've hung on to guys way too long after picking them in the Rule 5. But Herrera was just sort of the odd man out in that second base center field backlog in the Rangers system. So the Phillies plucked him, mm-hmm. and you know, he was like a 2 or 3 win player last year, hit for a really high average, you know, a fair bit of power. And he's an unorthodox player. He's got a bizarre stance. I have no idea how he hits anything, but you know, after he's done it for a season in the major leagues, you know, I don't know that there's a reason to think he won't continue to do that. I think the Phillies are pretty set on keeping him in center field, although, you know, there was a possibility there that he could be J.P. Crawford's eventual double play partner. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he could be a guy that you hit either first or like seventh or eighth once this team is good again. They got him for pretty much nothing. So, you know, he's just because of his weird stance, and he was probably the best player on the team last year, he's become a little bit of a fan favorite.
I want to compare two guys who were frequently compared as prospects, as Miguel Sano and Michael Franco, and not from a surface level thing, but what do you think is the difference between a guy like Sano coming up when the team's rebuild is kind of coming to a close versus Franco, who is going to be up in the midst of it? Do you think there's a difference in dynamics or a difference in how that player is viewed by the team?
I don't know if there's a difference in how the player's viewed by the team. I think front offices are pretty detached about that kind of thing.
Sure.
As far as fans go, I think that's a different question. You know, the Phillies pulled off essentially what the Twins are trying to do right now, which is to build that core of just monster position players. And you look at the difference between, I don't know if there's an analogous twin really, who was up this early, but you know, Jimmy Rollins was there for 6 years before the Phillies made the playoffs, whereas Ryan Howard, you know, had his first full season. You know, the Phillies were contending in 2005-06, right when Howard came up, when he was winning Rookie of the Year.
Brian Dozier would probably be the closest.
Yeah, but you know, Dozier was never like a huge prospect.
Not at
you know,
all.
Much as I love Brian Dozier.
Yeah, he was an org guy.
Yeah, he just kept hitting.
Yeah.
So you know, maybe Dozier was like the, you know, the first sign of the army coming over the horizon. The you know, the way Rollins was, and Franco was definitely that first guy for this group of Phillies players. I think that, you know, maybe this is just something that's born out of necessity. But Rollins really was that took on that public leadership role because he was the first good, like since 93, he was the first really good homegrown player, you know, that they knew was going to be there in the future. I guess Scott Rolen was there when Rollins came up, but you know, Rolen ever considered himself part of the Phillies' long-term plans. So, you know, maybe Franco takes on that leadership role. Maybe, you know, although really just the rumblings that I hear out of people who know Phillies prospects better than I do is that J.P. Crawford's going to be that guy that you know, he recognizes that this is his team, even if he's not up yet, and he's going to, you know, become the Rollins or the Chase Utley of the next good Phillies team, just in terms of leadership. I don't want to put, you know, Jimmy Rollins is a Hall of very good player. Chase Utley's in my mind, a Hall of Famer. So, you know, I don't want to put those expectations on Crawford yet, but you know, he's definitely got that potential.
I wanted to ask you though, like it's a good segue. What is the level of excitement for you regarding J.P. Crawford?
You know, if you had asked, if I was still professionally where I was, you know, 4 years ago, it would be unlimited. But you know, I've probably only watched about like 20 Phillies games last year at any level, just because they weren't that interesting at the major league level. And, you know, I haven't like completely sublimated my fandom to professional, objectivity, but you know, it's hard to do this for a living and still like, you know, freak out about Crawford. Mm-hmm. With that said, I would put him up there. It's hard to say this considering how well Corey Seager, Carlos Correa, and Francisco Lindor all played in their major league debuts last year. But as prospects, Crawford is in a class with those guys. You know, Crawford is now pretty much what Lindor and – or I think Lindor is the best comp for him, even though they're slightly different players. But Crawford could be, you know, that perennial all-star – in this golden age of shortstops we seem to be heading into. So
I saw
the hype
for him
is huge.
Yeah. I saw your level of affinity for Lindor today on Twitter. You had mentioned that you'd written about him quite a bit.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed following his ascent. I saw him as a 16-year-old on the USA U18 team. He was, I think it was 2010, with Lance McCullers and Henry Owens and a bunch of other guys, Bubba Starling. And he was the best defensive shortstop I had ever seen live at that age. And now, it's only gotten better as he's gotten to the big leagues. But I have to just say, as a brief aside, I share your admiration for Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, I don't know when that happened, but like sometime last year, I just, you know, Lindor showed up in every single piece I wrote. And I guess I've just inadvertently become a huge Francisco Lindor cheerleader.
Okay, so similar question to Crawford, but what are your expectations for Aaron Nola moving forward? He's obviously a pretty interesting arm.
Yeah,
maybe not top of the rotation guy, but definitely solid upper middle. Have you been impressed with what you've seen from him so far in his brief big league time?
Yeah, I think he's been fine. Nola is, you know, a player that I've had a longstanding viewership relationship with, because he came out and shoved pretty much immediately after coming to LSU. You know, he had a great super regional matchup when he was a sophomore, I think it was, with Jonathan Gray, who went number three in the draft to the Rockies out of Oklahoma. And he's just been a really fascinating player just because the curveball is so good, the command is so good, and I think the fastball is a little bit better than people give him credit for. You know, you talk about talking up a college pitcher's command is like, you know, saying he has a great personality, that like, if he had stuff, you wouldn't bring up the command first, but you know, he's got plenty of stuff. Just the
well, it's
command,
like Eshelman, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not like Eshelman.
No, I mean, Eshelman is the poster child for that though.
Oh yeah. And Eshelman, you know, sort of throws four below at, you know, sort of fringy pitches. So, but Nola's got a plus curveball. He's got, mm-hmm. you know, a low to mid 90s fastball and, you know, 6 or 7 grade command. And I don't think that makes him an ace, but that makes him, a 200 inning guy who puts up an above average ERA. I don't know, a great comp doesn't really, come to mind.
I feel like he's the kind of guy that everyone expected Kyle Gibson to be. Maybe not as many grounders, but polished college pitcher, gets to the big leagues quickly, and is just solid.
He's going to strike a lot more guys out than Gibson did, too. But
Gibson is improving that way.
I think is if you know from what I understand, what the Twins fans expected Gibson to be might be what Nola actually is. Yeah, that, like you said.
Yeah, that's probably more fair. And hopefully, Gibson trended a little better with strikeouts as the season wore on. But I definitely agree with the idea that Nola's stuff is going to pop more. You know, he's got more swing and miss stuff. Gibson's more of a sinker slider guy.
Yeah. And it's just, it's fun to, as a college baseball fan, to see a guy like that translate to the pros the way he has.
What's your take on the rotation? And the reason I ask is because comparing rebuilds, when the Twins were, working their way through it, they went very low ceiling. Mike Pelfrey, Kevin Correa, they let, a lot of guys run through there that there was never going to be a guy that would stick. And I kind of admire, granted, Jeremy Hellickson's not extremely high ceiling anymore, but he's I think he's on the right side of 30 or he's just barely 30. Yeah. Charlie Morton has some intrigue. And then the back end is filled with guys that have some level of interest. I just feel like they've aimed a little bit higher than the Twins did in their rebuild when it came to, who are going to be the mainstays in the meantime.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. And like you said, these guys aren't incredibly high ceiling. Maybe they're maybe if all goes well, they're guys you can flip for a non-trivial prospect for, to a team like the Cubs, maybe that might need a number four starter come the deadline. But right now, guys like Hellickson and Morton or Brett Oberholzer are there because somebody's got to throw those innings. This is eventually the rotation is going to depend on whether Nola and Jared Eichhoff can continue to be those sort of mid-rotation guys, whether you can fill in Thompson and Appel in there or Velasquez as well, and then eventually can you get a number one in there to stick in the front of that rotation. So this is – I'm not particularly interested in Morton or Hellickson, really.
Right.
Just as I wasn't with Aaron Harang last year. This is all about Nola and Eichhoff. And eventually, maybe this year, maybe next when Appel and Jake Thompson come up to the major leagues, seeing what we can get out of them.
And, the one thing I wanted to close with before we do all the sayonara stuff, what's a reasonable contention timeline for this Phillies club as currently constructed?
I don't know. I think they're going to be bad, but a little more fun this year, which
like 90 losses.
Yeah, it's not unreasonable. I think Pecota had them as like a 65 win team. Matt Winkleman, Phillies Minor Thoughts, had a really well thought out argument for why the Phillies are well poised to outperform, their Pecota or Zips projections this year. Around 70 wins, maybe a little better this year. And then, once Crawford comes up next year, maybe Appel, maybe Thompson, they start spending in free agency again. You could see them maybe advancing, 8 to 10 wins a year for the next couple years. So I guess that puts them as like a dark horse contender in 2018 and maybe in the mix in 2019. And, all of this depends on the state of the NL East, which is just, it's complete clown shoes right now. So who knows where the Nationals are going to be in 5 years or the Braves or the Mets.
Yeah. The whole thing is crazy in that pretty much all the rebuilding teams, I think there's six of them, are all in the National League too. So it's kind of a race to see which of those teams can climb to the top of the mountain and join a very crowded pack at the top. You obviously sense that there's going to be at least one or two really good teams sent home in October this year in the National League, and so it'll be interesting to see how that all evolves. Before we let you go, how can people find you on Twitter? I feel bad that we didn't do that at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, I'm at MJ_Bauman, BAUMANN. You can follow me there if you don't mind putting up with occasional live tweets of college baseball games on the weekend. I'm trying to cut down on the tweet volume, but sometimes I just got to keep myself occupied.
Well, these things happen. Also, Baseball Prospectus, Today's Knuckleball,
and D1 Baseball.
You also have a podcast that you've been doing with Paul Boyer and is it Liz Rocher?
Yeah.
Rocher. What's that all about?
That's called Defensive Indifference. You can We're on Podbean, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher. I think we've done one episode in the past 8 months, so it's it's sort of intermittent, because Paul works for MLB AM, so he's working nights, and Liz has a day job, and I'm writing, so I'm working nights and weekends. So we've just had a hard time getting all three of us together, but depending on. I'm busier now because I'm, doing these three writing jobs. I'm busier now than I've ever been. So, as far as, our schedules permit, we're going to try to get back on the horse a little bit this year. So you could, the last episode was when we played the Baseball Prospectus annual drinking game, which is spread across the internet like wildfire. So, you could peer deeply into our souls if you sit through that entire podcast. So go ahead. Sorry.
I just want to thank you sincerely for taking time out of your busy schedule. We're very glad to have you, and hopefully we can again very soon.
Oh yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
And so, like you had noted about your podcast, you can find us on iTunes. Look for Midwest Swing. I tweet out the links quite frequently at @Brandon_Warren. This is Midwest Swing at Midwest Swing Pod. You are listening to us on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Check out our new website, www.coldomaha.com. Check out our Amazon ads. If you shop on Amazon, you can easily put a few pennies in our pockets. But once again, thanks for joining us. This is Cold Omaha Podcast Network and Midwest Swing.
Hey there, it's Sam Ekstrom, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not perfect. I have vices. Most of us do. Maybe you're like Peyton Manning and you enjoy Budweiser. Maybe you can't resist Dairy Queen blizzards. Maybe you're into e-cigs. Hey, no judgment. I enjoy betting on sports. And if you also enjoy betting on sports for a little entertainment, you'll love the podcast featuring yours truly, Sam Ekstrom, along with Sam Verhulst, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Available on iTunes and on Stitcher. Don't dread the spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter @ColdOmahaMN.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.